The state of Maine's ocean waters. Some of the changes taking place in our marine ecosystem can be seen with the naked eye, such as the appearance of invasive species or shifting shorelines. But other changes are often below the surface, literally, and some happen on a microscopic scale. Still, scientists are watching these changes carefully. I'm Keith Shortall, and on this, the 50th anniversary of UMaine's darling Marine Center, we'll find out more about the work being done to take the vitals of our marine ecosystem and find out what we know and don't know about the health of the patient. We'll also look at what the latest science is saying about our marine life, in nature, and in the aquaculture industry. Where have all the mussels gone? And what does the proliferation of the green crab mean? And what's the latest on ocean acidification? And as always, we want to hear from you. Maine Calling plumbs the depths. First, this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. 50 years ago, the Darling Marine Center was founded when a retired Chicago insurance executive donated 127 acres of farmland to the University of Maine. Today, the center undertakes year-round field and laboratory research on a wide range of marine science disciplines, from optical oceanography to marine archaeology to deep-sea biology. Today we're going to learn more about the work that the center does and the threats facing Maine's aquaculture. With me in our studio, Heather Leslie. She's the new director of the Darling Marine Center, conducts research on ecology, policy, and management of coastal marine ecosystems. Bob Stenick is a marine ecologist at UMaine's Darling Center. His laboratories include the coast of Maine, its kelp forests, and the lobsters, sea urchins, and crabs that inhabit it. And Chris Davis is executive director of the Maine Aquaculture Innovation Center, a nonprofit organization supporting research and educational efforts that advance the economic development of marine and freshwater aquaculture in Maine. Chris is celebrating his 28th year of farming oysters on the Damariscotta River and is founding partner of the Pemaquid Oyster Company. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about our marine ecosystem or the Darling Marine Center? The number, 800-399-3566. Again, that's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, all of you, to Maine Calling. Heather, let's start with you. I guess what struck me about this after the 50-year anniversary is this is such a the patient here, the ecosystem, our coastal marine waters, such a large patient to keep an eye on, a complicated patient where you have to look at the microscopic level and sometimes be in a plane to look down at the vastness of it. How do you? It seems impossible. Like how is it organized in a way that where you feel like you actually have a good sense of what's going on?
So that's a really good question, Keith. How do we get a good handle on how our patient is doing? And in this case, looking at the Gulf of Maine, a really complex and dynamic system, we do need to take that 30,000 foot view, at least at a start. And so thinking about how our environment is changing in recent decades, how water temperatures are changing, how the pH of the ocean is shifting through time, but also understanding how the critters that live in the Gulf and the people who rely on those resources are changing their habits through time is really important. And one of the advantages that we have at the Darling Center is that we have experts, scientists and students who are focused on these different pieces of the system, and we're co-located and can work together and get a really good 30,000-foot view and then figure out when and how to zoom in, whether it's on the Damariscotta River where we're located or in other parts of the Gulf.
So because you're on the Damariscotta River, that's your sort of home field, so you know a lot about that, but you also, your scope is beyond that as well. Is the Damariscotta River kind of a good kind of test case for that? Can you extrapolate what you know about that to other waters?
Well, absolutely. So the Damariscotta River estuary, it is an estuary, salty, right outside our doorstep most of the times of the year. And then you go 8 miles up to the head of the tides area, and you're in a much more freshwater environment, and we have estuaries like that up and down the coast of Maine and in many parts of the coastal world. So what we learn in the Damariscotta River estuary is indeed relevant to other places. Our scientists are also working from the poles to the tropical regions. Bob, for instance, does a lot of work on coral reef ecosystems. And so we have this strong place-based focused in the Damariscotta where we've been working for 50 years as UMaine scientists, but we also are connecting our work to other locations.
And I notice I've read that scientists, you know, in California are here studying creatures in Maine. So it's not, you're not very territorial necessarily.
No, we have a lot of visitors that go back and forth. And in fact, the Darling Center was the first marine lab where I spent time as a young scientist. But I've had the good fortune to visit a lot of marine labs around the U.S. and around the world. And what's brought me back to Maine as director is the special combination of people and environment and that place-based focus that we have in Maine. It's really, like I said, there's other places where people are taking this long view, but the combination we have in Maine is a really unique one, and one is having open doors to visitors.
Bob Senek, you're featured occasionally in news stories, but it usually comes out as some sort of bad news. You know, something has happened, or a study has determined that a creature is here that shouldn't be here, or there's a problem with a resource. And that's how most people check in with this. They're not consumed with it as you are. But give us your sense then, stepping back from these occasional bad news headlines and banners, and give us a sense of how is the patient doing?
Well, part of a way to look at this is that when you look out over the ocean, it looks like it never changes. If you might see lobster pots, but if you took those lobster pots away, probably looked that way 200 years ago. And it gives a false sense that these are very stable systems, and they're not. They're highly dynamic. And we know that if you take century scale look, we used to have cod and groundfish on the coast of Maine. Most of them are very depleted in their abundance. Things that were formerly prey, like lobsters and crabs, have increased significantly. And some of these changes are viewed positively and some of them are viewed negatively. One positive change is look at what has happened with lobsters. Almost every year since 1985 has been a record harvest of lobsters. Most of the problems in the lobster industry recently are not biological. They're economic because they're flooding the market and sometimes the price per pound is really low. So it's a very dynamic system, and people are sometimes uncomfortable with change, and management of our ecosystem is really hard to do on a system that's changing so much.
So what keeps you up at night?
Well, the things that keep me up at night include the fact that temperature and ocean acidification are trending in a direction that could create some problems. We know, for example, southern New England suffered a massive shell disease of lobsters. 80% of the lobsters died and have not recovered. That happened in 1998. As water temperatures warm, it's possible that we could be seeing more disease. And right now, lobsters are nearly 80% of the marine resource value for the state of Maine. So I worry about that. I worry about the high reliance on a single species. It's sort of like, would you put all of your money into a single stock? Well, probably not. But what options do we have? And those are the things that I like to think about. That's what keeps me up at night.
Chris, as the oyster man here, what keeps you up at night about your specific, either your world or the ocean in general?
Well, I think the industry is challenged by a number of things. Some are biological, some are cultural, sociological. Access to the shorefront is an issue that the industry is facing. Keeping our working waterfronts working, I think, is something that we'd like to work towards. But biologically, I think Bob was right on the mark in terms of changing environment temperature, and that reflects in increased likelihood of disease, particularly. My farm in 2010 and actually all the farmers in the Damariscotta River in that year suffered an outbreak of a disease from southern latitudes that found its way to Maine, and environmental conditions were right. And we were hit with a severe outbreak of MSX disease, which wiped out about 90% of our adult crop that year. And so it's farming. We're all used to having crop failures, but this hit hard. And it was probably because of the environmental temperature regime was similar to what that disease sees in southern climates.
All right. We'll talk more about the effects of acidification and temperature and much more. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments as well. This is Maine Calling. And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, an update on Maine's aquaculture industry and the state of the ocean. With me in our studio, Bob Stenick. He's a marine ecologist at UMaine's Darling Center. Heather Leslie is the new director of the Darling Marine Center. And Chris Davis is executive director of the Maine Aquaculture Innovation Center. And we invite you to join the conversation as well. The number, 800-399-3566. You can email us, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is Larry Mayer. He's a marine biogeochemist at the Darling Center. I'll ask him what that means exactly in a moment. Over the years, he's worked in estuaries and coastal environments throughout Maine, as well as other parts of the world. He teaches chemical oceanography, human impacts on the ocean, and marine biogeochemistry. Professor Mayer, thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Now, first of all, let's get to this word, biogeochemist. There's a lot going on there. What is that exactly?
Well, it is a big word, and it means different things to different people. In my case, I liked playing with chemistry sets as a kid, and I liked being outside, so I studied geology. But I got a job at a lab with a lot of biological types, so I work on biological problems, but I bring chemical and geological tools to bear on those problems.
As an illustration, when you look at ocean acidification, for example, what can you tell us just generally about this phenomenon and what we know about what's causing it?
Well, the ocean is it's slightly alkaline generally, but it occasionally becomes a bit more acidic due to various processes. One of those processes is the production of organic matter by algae live in the water columns. They generally make the ocean a little less acidic, but when they die and they fall down, wherever they fall, they can make the ocean a little bit more acidic. So you have a natural cycle of alkaline acidic going on out there in response to all of the biology that's happening. So we're looking at how that cycle affects the pH in estuaries, where a lot of Maine's important commercial species live, and trying to fit it into other pressures on the acidity of the ocean, such as burning of fossil fuels that puts carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, or the, as Heather mentioned earlier, the input of rivers coming into the heads of our estuaries, which also bring fairly acidic water.
So the acidification process is somewhat man-made, as you're mentioning, and these are what are highlighted in news stories often. But you're also saying that you've discovered that there are also just natural things happening that change the acidification.
Yes, this cycle occurs naturally, and the job for us is to try to disentangle some of these human-created acidification events and put them into context of the natural cycles that are occurring out there. So an example of a recent project that we've done is I work with a variety of citizen monitoring groups up and down the coast, ranging from about Casco Bay up to Penobscot Bay. And they first got into the water as an alliance this past summer and were able to obtain a huge amount of data on these different estuaries. Maine is a wonderful place to study estuaries because we have so many different ones. And one of the somewhat surprising outcomes of the data from that project is that a lot of the acidification in the estuaries is coming from offshore. If you think of the ocean offshore, it operates a bit like a forest. You've got photosynthesis occurring way up high, and after all those algae produce their organic matter, some of that stuff falls down to the bottom, makes the bottom more acidic. So now the question is, how do you get some of that acidic water into these estuaries? And what we're seeing is that the estuaries are becoming acidified basically according to how deep they are, which is controlled by their geology. So deeper ones, such as the Sheepscot Estuary, seem to be importing more acidic water than ones with a very shallow mouth, such as, say, the Kennebec Estuary. And that was a bit surprising. It brings home this biogeochemistry business because it combines the biology and the geology and the chemistry, obviously.
And, right. And to the to the average person, the conventional wisdom would be, well, if estuary acidity is changing, it's because of runoff in the river or something happening nearby. But what you've discovered is this deep water phenomenon happening.
We've learned to appreciate the significance of the deep water. That's been observed in other places, but we certainly didn't suspect its importance when, say, last year I participated in the legislature's Commission on Ocean Acidification. We didn't fully appreciate a year ago, I think, how important this deep water access would be. Now, that said, there is freshwater acidification. We can see that effect in estuaries that have large rivers. And Kennebec is a very good example. And we can see it after big rainstorms. In the Damariscotta, we had a big rainstorm June a year ago, and we could see that slug of fresh water that was somewhat more acid moving its way on down the estuary. So all of the above are operating, and they're all operating alongside of this acidification from burning of fossil fuels. And the question is, how do you tease apart these different influences and manage for them?
Larry Mayer, thanks for joining us. Appreciate the time.
Certainly.
Larry Mayer, marine biogeochemist at the Darling Center. This raises another question, which is, as scientists, you want to tell the truth about what's happening. And I'm just wondering, though, is there do you ever feel sort of a danger to say, yes, there is this natural thing happening where politically this can be grabbed and used to say, see, it's not so much runoff from the rivers, that the truth can sort of be grabbed and used for political purposes or to distort in the media? Or do any of you think about that and simply just report what you're finding?
Well,
Bob?
We do think about that. I personally don't believe in sugarcoating the science in any major way. I got myself in a lot of trouble more than 25 years ago suggesting that lobster stocks were not in the process of crashing because I was observing a lot of babies on the seafloor. And a lot of people were upset because all the managers were saying we need to increase the gauge for lobsters. And this created a lot of problems. But ultimately, if you stick to the science and you say, here's the information we have, let's all look at it together and let's think about the best course of action. What I was seeing was the beginning of the population explosion that we see now. But the other problem that we have is that with things like climate change and ocean acidification, we talk about trying to avoid what we call the cul-de-sac of despair. I've given talks on occasions about coral reefs and about their bleak future. And I look up at the end, and everybody's staring at their shoes, and they think, "Oh, it's all going, going downhill." The fact is that it's really a dynamic system, and in many ways, we're seeing a lot of positive things going on. And in terms of, we may see overfishing of some stocks, and a lot of people hear about negative stories that have to do with climate change, but we still see. Black sea bass are coming into the Gulf of Maine, red hake are coming into the Gulf of Maine. One can make the case that the diversity of the Gulf of Maine is increasing because of warming temperatures. And so it's a highly dynamic system, and it's certainly not all bad. But I do think we have to stick to the truth.
And what about the sort of relationship that scientists now have with people who earn a living from the ocean? I can remember, covering 20 years ago, angry fights between scientists sort of caught in the middle between regulators and fishermen and because a lot was at stake and ways of life are at stake. I don't hear as much about that anymore. What I hear about are stories about the industries helping the science in a sort of a we're all in this together change. Is that my imagination or is that happened?
I'd like to step in on that because this is really an important breakthrough that happened at the Darling Center. Some of the research that I was doing and other people as well, we started working with the fishing industry. In the 1980s, I asked the local fisheries co-op, lobsterman co-op, to just remove their lobster traps. And they laughed at me. But then as we talked, I said, it's totally up to you. This is just between the two of us. And they did it, and then they started coming by, and they wanted to see what was going on. Pretty soon, I was going on board their boats doing sea sampling. Some of my students, one was Carl Wilson, was doing the sea sampling. He ended up getting his degree at the University of Maine through the Darling Center, went to DMR, became the chief lobster scientist, and today he directs research. And that's coming from this mindset that we work with the fishing community. We learn from them. We learn a lot from them. And then sometimes they learn a little bit from us. But that has really changed the nature of interactions with the fishing community.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us. And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today we're learning about the Darling Marine Center, which this weekend celebrates its 50th anniversary. With me in our studio, Bob Stenick. He's a marine ecologist at the Darling Center. Heather Leslie is the director of the Darling Marine Center, and Chris Davis is executive director of the Maine Aquaculture Innovation Center. Join the conversation. The number to join the program here is 1-800-399-3566. Chris, I wanted to go to you to ask the same question we were talking about before the break about this, I guess, a change in the relationship between fishermen, aquaculture operators, and scientists and regulators, et cetera.
Yeah.
How has that changed maybe since you began in the business?
Well, I can tell you, in some ways, it hasn't changed. The 50-year history of the Darling Center has been an incubator of sorts long before that term was ever coined. In terms of aquaculture, through the 70s and 80s, students, grad students, undergrads at the Darling Center finished their schooling, and many started aquaculture businesses nearby. Today on the Damariscotta River, four of the seven farms were all products of the Darling Center, students that had gone through there. In fact, the four largest aquaculture oyster farms in Maine came from the Darling Center. So it really has been a tremendous collaboration, and it's a combination of many of those people work with Darling Center researchers today to help solve problems, which is part of what I do at my center, is to connect industry priorities for research with the scientists that can help solve those problems.
So it was a good year class, I guess, for
yes.
Sorry,
well, it's been
to borrow
50
from the
good year
vernacular
classes.
We have an email from Susan, who asks, in the Western Bay in Trenton, Maine, there seem to be no mussels. What happened? Is there any hope the mussel population will recover? We've been hearing about this, Bob Stenick. What's going on?
Right. Well, I've been monitoring the mussels since really the 1970s, and this seems to be a statewide decline. And it's coincident with the remarkable rise of green crabs. Now, green crabs are not native to our coast. They've actually been in the Gulf of Maine since the 1800s. But the temperature that they do best in is a little bit warmer than your average temperature in Maine. And when we have unusually warm temperatures, they have population explosions. 2012, we had what's known as the oceanographic heat wave. This is from North Carolina up to the Arctic. It was unusually warm. And these guys were able to explode in abundance. They're voracious. They live mostly in the intertidal zone. And these mussels started disappearing. At Pemaquid Point, I've been monitoring those mussels every year, and they were gone for about 3 years. Recently, they've been coming back. And at the same time, we've been monitoring green crab abundance by using traps, standardized traps. The green crab populations, this is very preliminary, but it looks like they're declining again. And the cold winter we had last winter, probably helped that decline. So this is part of the ups and downs that are driven by the climate, and the consequences of an oceanographic event affecting a predator, then affecting not only mussels but also soft-shell clams that we care about, is all part of how the ecosystem is connected, and it's how it's a good example of how important it is to manage at an ecosystem level. You know, ecosystem-based management is the future because we have to deal with this complex interaction that's changing.
And I'm wondering, is the philosophy to we hear a lot about fighting the changes. What can we do to stop climate change or ocean acidification? But at the same time, there are those who are saying, well, we should also adapt to be reasonable about this and say, look, some of this is going to happen. What can we do to, you know, minimize the true damage? Is that part of the approach, for example, even in oyster farming at this point?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And can you give examples?
Well, the example of the disease outbreak. So the way we adapted was using selected lines of oysters, some of which were bred at the Darling Center, that show resistance to the disease, similar to land-based agriculture, not genetically modified, just selective breeding the way we've done with chickens and cattle. And so those selected lines are now being adopted by the industry, and they seem to be more resistant to the disease. And so that's one of the ways we've adapted.
Yeah, and in the case of the green crab, is there anything other than hope for really cold water temperatures in winters that we can do to minimize the impact?
Well, there have been a lot of efforts to try, can we trap them so much that they don't get into mudflats and into rocky shores? I don't know of any success there. Some cages have been developed that try to keep them out. But my sense is that they are so abundant that on the state of Maine and our 3,000-plus miles, we are pretty much at the mercy of how climate affects that particular species. So I think that's when we just have to simply sit and watch and see what happens.
Yeah. Heather, you mentioned earlier that scientists from all over the world, I guess, would say, come and study in Maine. Is there something about Maine that makes it an interesting subject for people who study marine ecology to look at, as opposed to, you know, the waters off the rest of the East Coast?
Well, I think there's a few reasons why people come back to the Darling Center. Some folks come back year after year, and that's been the case for decades. It's really wonderful to see. One reason is the community of people that we have at the Darling Center, some that's now expanded to include our summer students and visiting scientists, but the wintertime community too. And I hope some of you in the state of Maine who haven't been to the center will think about visiting in the off season. That community really does bring people back year after year. And there's also some uniqueness to the environment that makes it a great place to work, both in the coastal margin, like we've been talking about, but also terrestrially. We're on land. So we have folks that are studying insect behavior biology, for example. We have folks that are studying the development of marine organisms. And this is just a really great place to do that with our access to flowing seawater and other facilities. And if you're interested in learning more about these endeavors, I encourage you to come to our open house on Saturday from 10 to 2 to learn more.
Let's make sure we fit that in case we run out of time, because there are events around this, and we'll mention it again before the show is over. But what's going on to celebrate here the 50 years?
We're celebrating on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at 193 Clark's Cove Road in Walpole, Maine, just a little over an hour from Portland northward. And there's going to be celebrations for the kids activities. There'll be demonstrations with research equipment in the water off of our pier. And there'll be scientists talking about the experiments that they have ongoing related to the marine environment.
You mentioned kids, and so I have a 9-year-old.
Perfect.
And, when I was a kid and we went to the beach, we threw stuff and made sandcastles. He wanders around, looking for creatures and trying to identify them. Part of this is his natural interest, but part of it is also, I think, that there's really been an educational push to younger kids to get them interested in marine ecology specifically. And what's interesting to me is that they really are interested. They've just never been exposed maybe before to it. Is that part of your mission as well?
Absolutely. We're a real hub for marine education, experiential education for school kids in the area. We have folks that visit from all over the region during the school year. And we also offer programming for kids of different ages during the summertime, including some tours that we do on a weekly basis in the summertime.
So, Bob, are you fun to go to the beach with? You know, can you just go and hang out with Bob? Or are you going to go, oh, look, it's Helichondria fibrosa over there?
You'll have to ask my wife about that. you know, I do find the ocean endlessly amusing. And, you know, of course, I just also sit back and just love watching a sunset, you know, and or depending upon which beach you're on, a sunrise. But, right, I love to see what's new out there. And it's often right at your feet. A lot of the crabs that you see now, you wouldn't have seen 20 years ago. And I'm very interested in why have we seen that kind of a change? And so some of my research steered in that direction, yeah.
All right, he's fun at the beach. Okay, we're going to take another short break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Maine's aquaculture industry and the Darling Marine Center. With us in our studio, Chris Davis is Executive Director of the Maine Aquaculture Innovation Center, Heather Leslie, Director of the Darling Marine Center, and Bob Stenick, a marine ecologist at UMaine's Darling Center. Join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Bob Stenick, you mentioned earlier that all is not gloom and doom here, that there are actually some changes that are interesting and I guess possibly positive. But the appearance of new species, what are some of the signs, I guess, or indications that all change isn't bad necessarily?
Right. Well, some of the temperature changes are driving changes in the distribution of some species of fish. Red hake are coming in, and juvenile red hake are actually terrific food for our seabirds. We've got black sea bass, which traditionally were off the mid-Atlantic. They're increasing, and they're now managed. Recently, we've seen increases in crabs, and crabs this year became a species that is now being regulated by the Department of Marine Resources. Halibut is coming on strong in eastern Maine. Scallops are probably one of the best managed stocks that we have on the coast of Maine, with really the Department of Marine Resources doing a terrific job with them. Redfish are increasing from a significant low in the 1990s. So there are a number of species that are actually showing positive trends. And when you talk about, you know, good news and bad news, most people think about, well, things that I care about, and that's often things that employ people or that you want to eat. Otherwise, we have an ecosystem that's changing, and there's no such thing as a good or a bad ecosystem, but the services that they provide for us, I think that there are a lot of positive signs out there.
And there are concerns, obviously, that temperature may affect the lobster population?
Well, that's right. And there's a sweet spot. There's temperatures below which the baby lobsters don't settle to the seafloor and above which they don't live very well or they are disease-prone. And that sweet spot of temperature has been moving north and east along the coast of Maine. So that Stonington now is one of the best producing areas for lobsters in terms of a harbor. But when I started with lobsters, it was Casco Bay. And so you can see that movement. And if you keep that projecting that line, you can imagine a time when lobsters are going to be a relatively minor part of our ecosystem. And so how do we diversify our fisheries and think about this dynamic in a better way? And this is going to involve a lot of science. And I think that we're trying to gear up to answer those questions if we possibly can.
Chris Davis, does that changing ecosystem and the changing profile, the changing species in Maine, does that provide new opportunities for aquaculture?
I think it can. At this point, I'm not sure we've capitalized on that. But in general, the industry is, to sum it all up, tremendous opportunity for the aquaculture industry. We have the coastline, we have the water quality, we have our huge market for aquaculture product, whether it's shellfish, algae, or finfish. And so I think the industry is quite hopeful.
What about things like, as we're talking about the disappearance of mussels because of the green crab, is there a way to, you know, grow mussels in ways that, you know, mitigate that problem?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we've been growing mussels for 50 years. And some of that work started right at the Darling Marine Center, actually. We grow mussels on the bottom. We grow them hanging from rafts, and we grow them hanging from ropes just below the surface of the water.
Are there developments in aquaculture that, because of technology or just new knowledge, that are allowing really difficult species to be farmed that were either too temperamental or not cost effective to do?
Some of that's happening. It's most likely happening on the land-based systems that people are doing. But in terms of technology, one of the foci of our center has been putting what we call putting science into the site selection. Siting is a huge part of a growing industry. Where do you place a farm? Where's a good place? Where's a bad place? And the process can take a grower anywhere from 3 to 6 or 7 years before they know that they have the optimal site for their species. And so the last thing a grower wants to do is discover after 5 or 7 years that they chose the wrong site. So what we're working is doing is trying to put the scientists together with the growers and getting that learning how to collect the types of environmental data that can predict the growth of the species you're doing. And that's been our focus, is developing growth models so that you can say, oh, this site, an oyster, in 3 years will come to market. But if you move half a mile over here, you might get it to market in 2 years. Well, so, that is a huge impact.
And the coastline obviously is finite and in high demand, and there are issues about access, et cetera.
Sure.
So is there a sort of a movement toward more aquaculture, growing more of this for consumption, and how much of that is kind of how much of a barrier, though, is access and access to
Well, it's certainly growing. We're seeing about a 10% growth rate per year in terms of number of farms starting up. We've been working more and more with the commercial fishing sector, doing job retraining, helping the commercial sector to diversify for some of the reasons Bob mentioned. We're pretty much a single species commercial fishery. And so by diversifying, we've worked with a lot of lobstermen. They're not sure they're not going to sell their traps yet, but they are looking at aquaculture as a way to diversify their
industry. All right. And with that, we're out of time. So we'll have information on our website about the 50th anniversary events coming up. Thank you all for being here today. Appreciate it. Heather Leslie, director of the Darling Marine Center, Bob Stenick, marine ecologist at UMaine's Darling Center, and Chris Davis, executive director of the Maine Aquaculture Innovation Center. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Our volunteer Tommy Bazarian answered your calls. And executive producer of the program, of course, Jonathan Smith. I'm Keith Shortall, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.